Thank you very much, first of all, for I would like to take the opportunity to thank Dr. Albertina Albers-Lorenz and Dr. Marcus Gehring for inviting me here and for being here, for having such a wonderful community of European and competition lawyers. The idea of presenting about the impact of the current crisis came to me after doing some presentations to my undergraduate and postgraduate students, considering the recent developments in financial markets and precisely the Commission intervention via state aid in restructuring banks. So I thought about writing something to challenge the doctrine, what I call the doctrine or the theory of too big to fail, and whether it has constitutional legitimacy in the treaty. And obviously, after including certain aspects concerning the economic and social impact of the current crisis, I kind of felt that the title deserved to be broader. So that's why you find that it's not about the impact, it's about the social and economic cost of the crisis. The paper is obviously broader in scope, and the methods I was looking at from an interdisciplinary perspective of what has been identified as the root of the crisis in different areas of law. For example, in banking, finance, I felt that the investigations currently going on about credit default swaps were not something I was a specialist from a competition point of view, so I needed first to see the responses to the crisis from the financial banking perspective. And the same goes on with corporate governance. From a corporate governance perspective, there are certain issues that have been expressed in this regard. So the first part looks briefly at the nature of the banking crisis, then it goes with the catalogue or classification of causes or what in fact went wrong in the current crisis. And then I have created a scenario, because I also taught in the past contract law, where I was challenging the perspective of whether the mortgage or the subprime market is really the problem of the crisis. And I was looking how state policy, macroeconomic policies, have actually influenced decision-making of individuals and of private economic actors. So this is where I have integrated, and I have discovered that there is a broader scope for engaging with macroeconomics and with macroeconomic policies, to which obviously you come to the last, to question the constitutional legitimacy of such bailouts on the basis of the current treaty framework. And the last point, possibly I will refer to them briefly. The LIBOR scandal is something that has possibly, everyone has heard of that. The potential for competition authorities to engage with the manipulation of exchange rates has never been considered in the past. So this was a kind of novel anti-competitive practices that I find difficult to reconcile with the previous approach. So that's why I was kind of expanding. And the final aspect of it, I think, is the criticism having to do with liberal, the liberal ideology and the way it has been interpreted and implemented in practice to achieve financialization. I think that's the point where I was looking very much in the negative, apart from fundamental freedoms that have brought many benefits. So briefly, what I have identified on the nature of the crisis, obviously, it's possibly not, there is no real need to engage why it affected the banking sector. The point to stress here is that when dealing with bailouts and administering state aid, the Director General for Competition, I felt, was not prepared to analyze whether or not there was a systemic risk of collapsing. What I have found in the literature, also in the US, that point out there was a big issue and that the too big to fail and too big to supervise has in fact been created by deregulation, on the one hand, repealing acts that made a distinction between commercial bank and investment banks. So this has been a major step And a second major negative direction has been the fact that they were allowed to merge. So they were allowed to, in fact, decrease the number of financial institutions worldwide. And this has happened in both in the US and the EU. So in other words, we can blame, let's say, the regulatory system for creating the conditions of the too big to fail. On the other hand, obviously, the risk of default, at least from our perspective, from the European Union crisis, has been with the risk of default not only of banks, but of member states, to which I referred in my paper to Greece, because there the problem was even more serious in the sense that it was a question mark of a turn in the crisis to a solidarity question. And this is something that constitutional experts indicated that Article 125 is in fact prohibiting the potential to be liable or assume commitments of central government. So I kind of framed this as a real test for social economic integration, so going beyond economic integration, whether member states will support a failing state. So this is the turning point. Obviously, the middle part of it, what exactly happened, it is my suggestion that it has to be seen from the perspective of what the state did to create the condition for the crisis, to generate the crisis of such proportion. And here I felt that if you look at the long-term perspective, the fact that they have maintained very low interest rate, and that's not a short-termist policy, they have encouraged a credit boom, and in a way they have encouraged access to easy credit. And this has obviously had consequences that many people were engaging in mortgages application. And on the basis of the figures of bailouts, at least in the US, I think the figure was much higher, like 8 trillions. I felt that the direction and the point that the subprime market was the starting point in the US is not entirely correct, because it's not only what happens with individuals when they apply for a mortgage, they lose their jobs, and thereafter there is the risk of default, and then the risk of default spreads to the whole financial system. There are other transactions that have been minimized in the past, and these are the over-the-counter negotiations of derivative contracts, which in fact assume there would be a process of securitization in the sense that the debt or credit worthiness would be somehow hidden, and there would be intermediation somewhere. Investors were actually guaranteeing for that credit worthiness. And this type of sophistication was the real problem that emerged in a major problem for the global economy. Now, the recent data I had was indicating that the over-the-counter derivatives contracts are somehow 9 times higher than the real economy, which makes sense to say that it is not only the mortgage, subprime mortgage market, but it's broader than that. So we don't really know where to expand. On the roots of the crisis, if I were to actually summarize what's the main problem, I would say that the main problem has been the fact that there were macroeconomic imbalances. So there are simply too many indicators at macroeconomic level, for example, the need to ensure you have sound public debt balance, a sound public debt balance. So it means avoiding large and persistent current accounts deficits. This coupled, obviously, with the long period of low interest rates. And I should add, perhaps, if one would question why exactly would the state be interested to maintain a low interest rate, the speculation has been that the state needed to refinance public debts. So in other words, maintaining a very low interest rate meant that the state was able to borrow money at record level. So this all goes hand in hand with what happened in the subprime market and encouraging, obviously, more risk-taking on the part of banks. All of these are found in different areas, such as banking, finance, and the like. What I wanted to do is to classify it so that I can, let's say, put the blame on one category or identify the connections that exist or how they have influenced each other. So the very first obvious category is to think what the state did wrong. And from this perspective, everybody pointed out at the lax monetary policy and the fact that they tolerated the so-called shadow banking. So in other words, they allowed banks to become too big to fail. But this has to be seen from the perspective of influencing private economic actors' behavior. With my problem question scenario, whether it is the individual bias and whether behavioral economics will have a word to say why so many individuals have engaged in risk-taking. The challenge here is that since the state has encouraged in advance such a behavior, a lot of the blame can be put on the state. However, if we want to actually look at private economic actors, the emphasis has been on financialization and financial intermediaries, special purpose vehicles, and all kind of instruments in special contracts and finance contracts that have been sophisticated enough not to alert anyone about the risk of taking such investment portfolios. And obviously, since banks were, in fact, not under the scrutiny of competition authority as they should have been, so they were allowed to merge, it did not meant that they did not compete with each other. So from the perspective of corporate governments, the emphasis is on the bonus culture, the fact that managers were incentivized to actually take on risky portfolios through these kind of generous bonuses. And this leads us to question what happened wrong with policy. And in here, I can only say that a lax monetary policy or a policy that is fixated in the idea that you have to avoid public spending and public debts has meant austerity and has meant job cuts with the consequence that unemployment figures are not included in the macroeconomic indicators they have considered to include in the treaty. As to law inaction, corporate governance has always pointed there was no financial regulation put in place, so that was a kind of soft law area with some codes of conduct, but not really. From our point of view, because we look at all these contracts, I think the difference is that in the UK in particular, in the US, the difference in the common law, the perspective on contract is very much different from the traditional approach on the in continental Europe, where you have the division of special contracts and you have you already know about risky transactions where the moral hazard is there, so you are kind of alerted to the fact that you cannot buy another person's debt, and you cannot, in fact, stand there for him as a guarantor. That will imply a risk. On the reaction of European institutions, I felt, if I want to sum up their kind of proposals, when they realized that there was a problem with credit rating agencies, they started to do something about it. When they realized that the problem was in the mortgage subprime market, they had a proposal on that. Then they had a proposal on banking taxation. Another proposal was about a directive on hedge funds, again used to guarantee to actually take on the risk if say the interest rate will increase, or whether there will be a speculation on a currency and the currency will fall, and the like. So I felt that the responses to the crisis on the part of the European Commission, even if they were justified, were not fixing or not doing enough for the crisis, in the sense that a better answer would have been to actually look at the macroeconomic indicators and the fact that economists kind of feel that the convergence criteria, that are the criteria for member states joining the single currency to meet in terms of macroeconomic policies such as inflation, and I will come back to these, were kind of rigid. and they were not leaving any freeway to member states. So there has been some sort of perceived rigidity by economies that you can't do much to fix the crisis, looking at these indicators. And obviously, we can also blame the society in general for taking on the risks unnecessary. Ideologies, for example, Professor Richard Posner in his book on the failure of capitalism indicated that there has been a problem with liberal ideologies in particular. Others have pointed at the fact that there is a lack of experimental macroeconomics. We have too many indicators, like we have to address the issue of public debt, spending. We have to address the issue of avoiding inflation, deflation, and also avoiding unemployment. At the same time, we don't know what will be the likelihood of a negative impact when we adopt a long-termist perspective, such as lowering the interest rate. So everything has been, let's say, experimented on us with this crisis. And the final point that I identified on the basis of my research is that there has been reliance on certain influential economists about different theories of employment, about different responses to the crisis applied to different prehistorical conditions, for example, in the context of the crisis in the 30s, that do not necessarily reflect what we should do these days or to our problem. So I guess about the scenario that I was trying to introduce my students with what happened in the subprime mortgage market, my understanding of the possible bias here is not necessarily one that looks at behavioral economics exclusively, but one that looks at how the state has influenced such a decision-making bias. And in terms of enforcement, I felt it is useful to recall that we have a divide at European Union level among competition and, on the other hand, consumer law, whereas in consumer law, there is some potential to expand what is wrong with information asymmetries, the fact that consumers, when they are signing their contracts, don't know in advance about certain transaction costs that are potentially hidden. But this is not the task of competition authorities. They are going to say this is very much what you do in the area of contract law with the misrepresentation and possible fraud. So this is one such explanation where the division of laws has actually acted against us. On the other hand, if one looks at what exactly triggered the crisis, my understanding was on the basis of a scenario, say, but for these interest rates that were so low, consumers would not have mortgage, and at the same time, banks wouldn't have assumed risk in lending. I felt that if one starts to analyze what is in fact the cause, the effect, and the result, one can say that it was the multiplier effect that triggered the whole crisis. At the same time, I found inspiration in Hayek's theory of a trace cycle, the fact that he pointed out that the crisis in the 20s was in fact a government action problem, and that it was the kind of misinformation by the central bank which awakened the crisis in the banking system. So in other words, he seemed to be sympathetic with the idea that maintaining an interest rate that is not the natural, the real interest rate to prevail in that market was in fact the major problem. And we can see that the lax monetary policy plays the same role for us these days. On the other hand, only to pick an aspect that has relevance for what I'm going to emphasize about the social cost, I felt that the current treaty in saying that we aim to achieve full employment is in a way not compatible enough with what Keynes suggested in doing whatever it takes to create employment. And this has to be seen also compared to contrasting Hayek's rejection, at least as an advice to the UK, in the context of the previous crisis in the 20s, where he suggested that Great Britain had a problem with maintaining very rigid wages. So Great Britain should have opened up the market and created better conditions for flexible wages, creating competition for jobs as a way out of the crisis. So my initial reaction is that perhaps there has been too much emphasis on this type of influencer who actually gave good and useful advices for a particular context, and they were later relied upon as if they were gospels or alike. So I felt there is an austerity imprint that comes from this perspective that was useful, but for another context. Now to talk a bit of on the macroeconomics dimension, I think here I can only make the special emphasis that there has never been a proper interpretation of what exactly is the principle of open markets with free competition, in the sense that this has been it has been placed in the treaty under a chapter concerning economic and monetary policies. So this has not been fully grasped, so to speak, and the application in practice has never been implemented because nobody actually questions that competition authorities only care about what happens. Rules are there for undertakings, not for what is the state mission regarding maintaining price stability, sound finances, and the like. As I mentioned earlier, what I felt, it was a kind of heavy criticism engaged by different economies writing about the problems generated by the financial crisis, is that if you look at the indicators, you have inflation, but again, this is somehow reflected by the three best performing member states. And many have claimed this is not good because we don't have the same level of economic development across European Union member states. At the same time, there has been a kind of, as I said, the austerity imprint and the heavy focus on public deficits and tackling that. So measures have been implemented to cut public debts. And the other drawback is that if you look at the convergence criteria, there is no mention of an unemployment target overall. And this has been obviously, this has had devastating consequences for us. And if we look at the current outlook, it is somewhat positive in relation to inflation. They are meeting the target, and these are the latest from Eurostat. But most worrying, and these are also latest figure, is the social cost. That is to say, having 11.9% unemployment level for the Eurozone. It's much lower outside the Eurozone overall. And the fact that the long-term unemployment rate is 86% higher than the preceding 4 years, which is again worrying, and this is in contrast with what the UK economy predicted in the short term. And this has made me question, in a way, also Keynes' theory about creating full employment, because according to that, you will have you will need to have 5% unemployment rate. Given that his advice and his theory dates back to the 30s, when the global population was 1.8, and now we have three times as many, we might not be able to achieve, they might be too a very ambitionistic goal, so to speak. However, I felt that if I made my calculations on the basis of the active population and the like, I wanted to see how many people are in employment from the global population, and the percentage is 41. And this is an important indicator of why things are in the negative for the European Union as a whole. To which I add, so apart from the social cost problem, I add what happened with the to fail implementation and the banking restructuring. If you look at the state aid granted during 2002 up to 2007, the figure is very modest. For the gross domestic product, so 0.1 is fine, but the figure is actually unacceptable immediately thereafter when they started to rescue banks and to restructure banks through banking communications. So I felt it is an alarm bell that has to ring somewhere, that if they continue this way, they might exhaust the gross domestic product at a later stage with a serious consequence for the economy. This is possibly also the explanation why more recent statements from the Director General for Competition say that rules granting state aid is going to be made more difficult. Of course, one cannot talk about costs without looking at the justification. Why was it possible to actually proceed with bailouts? And here, I mean, there are arguments definitely against, such as Article 123, specifying that purchase of debt instruments and all the financial instruments, over-the-counter derivatives, credit default swaps, repos and the like, they all qualify in this syntax of debt instruments. So the prohibition of overdraft facilities or any type of credit facility will run against. And the same will run against if we interpret the fact that the adoption of economic policy has to be based on the close coordination of member states and to be conducted in accordance with the principle of free competition that has to guarantee that resources are allocated efficiently. So in other words, the same way as in competition law, you are not allowed to use as an objective justification the inefficiency. So you have to prove there are certain benefits passed on to consumers. The same way, we cannot say that we can take such a huge resource, let's say 40% of the GDP, the union GDP, and transfer it. So in other words, making the corporate responsibility of banks and financial institutions being passed on to consumers via taxation. So that was my main concern. Now, obviously, if I look at the normative ranking, they are in the treaty, and so is the provision of Article 107.3 that says you can grant state aid to remedy a serious disturbance in the economy of a member state. So in a way, the legitimacy was thought on the basis of this provision, which is in fact closing somehow a debate, because the same provision has constitutional ranking. However, I would still emphasize there is a clash between the two, because efficient allocation of resources is actually working at the supranational level where you have macroeconomic policy, whereas state aid is in fact an exception to what we do when we police undertakings not to engage in anti-competitive behavior. So I would find good arguments relying on the banking communications being rather soft law and perhaps not binding for saying that there might be a justification for recognizing that you can claim money back in the light of the recent decision, a court ruling in Pringle. The court doesn't seem to endorse this view. So here's the area, let's say, of dispute. This is what they have done. Am I out of time?
No?
Fine. So I felt the justification here on efficiency is a lot, give rise to further questions and controversial disputes, I would say, because it, all the time in competition, there has been a problem that where do we have efficiency in the treaty? And we have efficiency in the treaty in the wrong place, so to speak. But I would say it is where it should be, because you can't ensure the effective redistribution of resources without considering taxation and how such costs will be passed on to consumers. And finally, this is where I kind of touch the ground with what we have in competition more recently. And I found a discrepancy in the Commission's approach initially when they were issuing banking communications, for example, dealing with impaired assets and advancing a restructuring of banking. They have issued including a pricing guidance on injections regarding credit default swaps. If one looks at credit default swaps and other financial derivatives from the perspective of finance, financial experts will agree that these are toxic, very risky portfolios of engineering debts. So the Commission, in the first instance, issued this kind of guidance and calculated how much they should price them. And now more recently, the Commission sent a statement of objections to 13 investment banks that were that are involved in derivatives. So there is somehow new data emerging about the fact that, as I mentioned at the beginning, these type of transactions exceed the real economy. So they go somewhere beyond. The LIBOR scandal is probably, let's say, better known. Yeah, because there, the U.S. court had a major problem since the Sherman Act doesn't deal with economic monetary issues. We are lucky we have a treaty so that we can move from one area to another. They have a division with the unfair methods of competition, and they also have the repealment of the Act that, in fact, divided investment from commercial banks. So in other words, the judicial reservation is even higher to do anything. Also, the kind of explanation that they were offering in relation to the fact that panel contributors are in fact submitting only a quote, so they only submit an estimate of the exchange rate, but the actual exchange rate is something that will be taken into account after the evaluation of all the panel contributors. So this has been a heated argument, at least by certain competition lawyers doing cartels, whether this is something that we can label as collusion. And unfortunately, the judicial approach in the US does not support this view, because they are very prone to seeing you have to prove there is a restraint of trade, you have to prove that there is harm to competition and the like, and this is not something you can do in this context alone. So the relevance of 119 or 120, at least for us, could be usefully used in order to emphasize that this type of manipulation can be done, let's say, when you are outside the Eurozone, because if you are in the Eurozone, then there is the system of the European Central Banks and the European Central Bank that will stop you. But if you are not in the Eurozone, you can do that. So in other words, banks and banking panels contributors could engage in manipulating exchange rates. And this could be an issue for further consideration from this perspective, which is complicated enough, I would say. And there is the risk, if you are working for a competition agency, to actually admit it if, let's say, the legal basis does not allow your legal standing before the court. And this has made me, together with all the securitization aspects, to challenge the understanding of what went wrong. And obviously, the last point of my paper has focused on understanding the different traditions that we have in the EU, the emergence of neoliberal ideologies, and the way this type of economic governance have been shaped from the kind of ordered freedom, what was initially meant by ordoliberalism in January, with a shift away from that to the idea of a kind of coerced competition where you kind of have to agree to what is put on the table by others. In corporate governance, the discussion is very much that there is a failure of governance. Now, how this failure will be addressed is a very difficult question. My understanding so far is that the more indicators you have, the more complex the formula will be, so the more difficult it is for economists to predict. Because if it's enough difficult, if it's difficult enough to predict what would be the negative impact for one economy or how the economy will evolve, it is even more difficult to predict these days with the financialization of services and the fact that any negative shock wave will affect other states. so possibly also what will happen in the US. And obviously, I think the point to stress here is that Keynes remains valid, and the way out of the crisis should be reconsidering and strengthening the role of tackling unemployment and getting rid of the idea of the obsession to the obsession for austerity. And the final point, obviously, is if we compare neoliberalism with ordoliberalism. Initially, the German current in Freiburg had a problem with the type of intervention in the economy, which is something that we have experienced with too big to fail. So in other words, it's very much a crisis of intervention, of how much intervention will the state have in the economy. So thank you very much, and I am happy to hear your questions.
Yes.
I have.